Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Extinction Rebellion. Well, they've shut down parts of London for the last week or so, all over Easter. A global campaign that started right here in Bristol. We hear from some of the brains behind Extinction Rebellion from Bristol University, cognitive psychology Professor Colin Davis, speaking at Redland Library recently, and also XR activist Luke Watson. But what's more dangerous, climate change or war and terrorism? It's a bit difficult to know what we should be frightened of most, isn't it, sometimes? Sri Lankan terror attack, Christchurch terror, and the fire at Notre Dame in Paris. We speak to Manfred Petrisch, who runs a blog in German called Alles Schall und Rausch, which in English is All Smoke and Mirrors. What does he make of the terrorist attacks over the last couple of weeks? Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show. We start with Professor Colin Davis from the Cognitive Psychology Department at Bristol University from XR.
I would like to thank all of the friends of Redland Library. I am the child of librarians. My father taught librarianship. My mother worked for a while in one of those mobile libraries. I spent much of my youth, formative years in libraries, and so I really value the importance of these places, and I'm very grateful for all of those of you who are trying to defend our public libraries. I'd like to focus on political dissent, and specifically forms of dissent that might seem to go beyond usual participation in democracy. And I've chosen two books on that theme, and the first is called Disobedience and Democracy by Howard Zinn. So let me start by saying a few words about the author. Howard Zinn was interested in civil disobedience, both from a philosophical and a practical perspective. Between 1956 and 1963, he was a professor of history at a college for African-American women in Atlanta, Georgia. And during that time, he became a participant in the civil rights movement. And one of the first campaigns that he was involved in was actually about public libraries. So in Atlanta, up until 1959, libraries were segregated. And quite apart from the moral aspects of that, that was a major obstacle to learning if you happened to be black. So Zinn and his class decided that that would be a good place to translate some ideology into action. And when Zinn visited the library and he spoke to the director there, he was told that change was not possible because if Negroes began to use the library, it would probably lead to violence. And you can read more about that campaign in one of Zinn's essays. But ultimately, the desegregation happened quietly and peacefully, and the library patrons didn't respond with violence. And Zinn quotes the governor of Atlanta, who commented, "A public library is a symbol of literacy, education, and cultural progress. It does not attract troublemakers." I think the first sentence is true. I'm less sure about the second. I guess it depends on your point of view about who's a troublemaker. The president of Spelman College seemed to decide that Zinn was a troublemaker, and he eventually fired him for radicalizing students. So this book, Disobedience and Democracy, it was a response to a book called Concerning Dissent and Civil Disobedience that was written by a Supreme Court justice called Abe Fortas. Both these books were written in 1968, which was quite a revolutionary year across the world. The Beatles were number one in the charts with a single that had Hey Jude on one side, but Revolution on the other. And it really did seem that We All Want to Change the World captured the zeitgeist. The Vietnam War was still going on, and it was a source of much dissent. And Zinh himself was arrested a number of times for protesting against the war. Many young men burnt their draft cards as a public act of disobedience to draw attention to the immorality of the government's bombing campaign, as well as the fact that the war had never been voted on by Congress. And it was these acts of civil disobedience that particularly prompted Judge Fortas's book. He considered whether draft card burning should be protected by the First Amendment on free speech, and he concluded that it shouldn't. Now, Howard Zinn was not impressed by Fortas's arguments, and he identified 9 fallacies in the reasoning. In the process, he sketched out a much more general case for civil disobedience, one that I think has relevance for today. And let me briefly say a little bit about why I think these arguments are particularly relevant for the present. And it's something that Lloyd has already alluded to. As in 1968, there is a spirit of rebellion in the air. And one of the reasons people are rebelling is to get governments to respond appropriately to the climate crisis. Many of us have been trying normal methods to bring about a change in government policy for a long time. But it hasn't been working, and the situation now is getting rather desperate. What we do over the next few years may be critical for whether humans in the future will continue to have a viable habitat. If you want to read more about the world we're heading towards, I highly recommend this recently published book, The Uninhabitable Earth, by David Wallace Wells. The opening sentence of the book is, "It is worse, much worse than you think," and it goes on to explain why. An article in The Ecologist this week says that perhaps David Wallace Wells is being too optimistic. So faced with this, many people, myself included, are turning to civil disobedience. The Extinction Rebellion campaign is based on the idea of using mass civil disobedience to try to bring about change. You might have seen the naked protest in Parliament last week. That was people from Bristol. Next week, the international rebellion will begin. And in the UK, thousands of people will converge on Parliament Square on Monday and will cause disruption, will engage in acts of civil disobedience. That will probably get us arrested. So rather than Desert Island books, you might say that I'm choosing police cell books. Our hope is that our protest will wake people up about the climate emergency and that we might be able to persuade the government to take action. But many people are going to be unimpressed by what we do. Some will say that we're wrong simply because we're breaking the law, but others will have more thoughtful criticisms. So for that reason, I think it's worth looking at Zinn's arguments. And I'm going to mention just a few of the fallacies that he talks about that I think are pertinent to the present. His fallacy number 3 is that civil disobedience must be limited to laws which are themselves wrong. I think most people would agree that there may be a justification for breaking laws that are unjust. But Zinn argues that it's also legitimate to break just laws in the service of protesting against other bad laws or bad conditions. He gives the following example. Suppose a child is killed by a speeding car and local mothers respond by blocking traffic on the street to try to pressure the council into installing a traffic light. Judge Fortas would say that this form of civil disobedience is not justifiable because the law that they're breaking against obstructing traffic is perfectly reasonable. But Zinn says that the lives of children who live on the street are more important than traffic ordinances, and therefore this is a justifiable form of disobedience. Then he raises the stakes and asks about a situation in which many more lives are at danger. To quote from Zinn, "Is it impermissible to violate a law which is in itself reasonable and harmless, like a law against obstructing traffic, as an attempt to criticise, to halt the mass destruction of war?" And if you substitute our habitat for war in that sentence, it could be seen as a direct defence of Extinction Rebellion's tactics. And many people will respond to this argument by saying that there's no need to break the law at all because we have political processes at our disposal. We live in a democracy. We can exercise our right to vote. But that's another fallacy that's discussed by Zinn, because it's not clear that the usual political processes were helpful in bringing about reforms like, for example, the civil rights laws that he talks about. Instead, usual politics seems to be very much about preserving the status quo. And sometimes you need to go outside the usual legal framework in order to bring about change. Now, maybe that wouldn't be necessary in a well-functioning democracy, but our system is very far from that ideal. Ultimately, though, the differences between Zinn and Judge Fortas seem to come down largely to one fundamental difference. Fortas places a high value in the law in and of itself, whereas Zinn holds that morality is the ultimate guide. His fallacy number one is that the rule of law has an intrinsic value apart from moral ends. He argues that that's just misguided. From his perspective, civil disobedience is not just to be tolerated. If we're to have a truly democratic society, it's a necessity. So I find myself agreeing with Zinn rather than Fortas. But I think my sympathy for Zinn is very much rooted in the fact that he is a man of action, not just nice words, and that he has a keen sense of justice, and he's always rooting for the underdog in society. From a purely intellectual point of view, I do have some reservations. I don't think he provides an unassailable case. I think while he's right to talk about our morality being our ultimate guide and a source of obligations, I think maybe he dismisses some of Fortas's arguments too readily. And in particular, it's reasonable to talk about citizens having an obligation to obey the law. But when circumstances give rise to a conflict between those two obligations, between our conscience and the law, we need to weigh them carefully to see which one takes priority. It's expecting too much of philosophy to be able to do that in the abstract. Individual citizens have to make the judgment for themselves and recognize that their perspective may differ from others and be prepared to face the consequences for taking a perspective that differs from the majority or from that specified by the law, and realizing as well that those two might not always coincide. Finish with another quote from Zinn, which is, "Democracy is not just a counting up of votes, it is a counting up of actions."
That was Professor Colin Davis from the Cognitive Psychology Department at Bristol University from Extinction Rebellion.
My name's Luke Watson. I'm a member of Extinction Rebellion.
So, Extinction Rebellion, we see XR. Actually, it should be ER, shouldn't it?
Yeah. Doesn't roll quite as well, I think, for the sound of it.
No, it doesn't, does it? No. And also, it wouldn't go with the hourglass logo that you've got. Now, look, this is quite a new campaign. Can you just tell us about how it started? Although it's got a lot of press coverage, and obviously the people involved in it are very active.
Yeah. It's an offshoot of a group called Rising Up. It started about 2 years ago in Bristol.
And what other, is it in other parts of the country? Is it just Bristol?
No, it's international, not just the UK.
So did it start in the UK?
It started in Bristol.
Wow, amazing. So what are you up to? What are you actually doing? Maybe we should start with what have you been doing so far?
So far is more been recruiting and doing some symbolic events to raise awareness of the movement.
So I noticed you did something up at Bristol Airport, didn't you?
Yeah. There was already a group doing that, in a way.
Okay.
Because a lot of people in XR have been involved in activism for a while.
Okay, so this is basically environmental activists all coming together under one kind of heading, is it?
Yeah, one shared vision of how change works.
So how does change work?
I mean, there's lots of different ways you can go about change, but the...
But we're seeing that a lot of people voting in the Houses of Parliament are almost ineffectively for the last few months. But anyway, what's your
view is that non-violent direct action in the capital city is the most effective way of bringing about a change in government.
And how would that affect anything? And what I suppose even more important, what is nonviolent direct action?
Nonviolent direct action is breaking a law you believe to be wrong in a symbolic way in order to both highlight the injustice of that, and it also shows the violence inherent in maintaining the status quo.
Ah, well, enforcing the law, I mean, there is surely a sense in that as well. I mean, if, you know, some friend of yours gets murdered, you've got to go to the police and they've got to enforce the law, haven't they?
That's true, but part of nonviolent action is to be accountable. So it's not like we're trying to break the law and then get away with it. We're saying we do this because we believe this is wrong.
You think we're willing to change the law?
We're willing to interact with the law. Accountability kind of shows that.
Okay, so we talked. I mentioned the Bristol Airport action. What other things have been going on here locally that have come under this XR heading?
People glued themselves to the BBC, the local Bristol BBC. That was one thing.
Why?
Because one of the key messages of XR is speak the truth, and the BBC has a key role in shaping public discourse.
Well, they certainly do. I mean, through the Natural History Unit, for example, they're one of the people in the national arena that are bringing quite a lot of these environmental issues out through their programmes, aren't they?
They are bringing the issues out, but not to a degree necessary.
So if you were at the BBC producing a programme, what would it look like? So it was different to what they're doing. So all I'm saying is, what would you like the BBC to be doing?
Probably to treat it as an emergency, not as something where you can carry on the lifestyle we have. That is not possible anymore. And we have to be honest about that. That radical change is required, not because it would be nice, but for the world to be habitable for future generations.
So you're saying there is no alternative except for doing what you want?
No. That's XR is not advocating a particular policy. We're just saying that how we are now is heading to disaster.
Okay, so but it does sound as if you haven't really got a vision. Is that fair to say? Or other than saying that the situation we're in now isn't working? I mean, isn't it part of your responsibility to be saying, rather than cursing the darkness, to be showing a light, to be leading the way a bit as well, if you've really thought through these issues?
Well, we believe that it's a systemic issue. And we also believe quite strongly in democracy, which would be great if we had it. And so one of the demands is for a citizens' assembly so that our politics will be representative of the people of the country. And we don't think it's up to us as a minority group to decide. So instead we're asking for a procedure which we... And then it's kind of a matter of faith in people, I suppose, which might be misplaced.
Well, I mean, I think more people involved in decisions sounds a good idea, because it seems to me a very tiny number of people, most of them chief executives of big corporations, who are, by the way, also funding political parties, are making most of the decisions at the moment. Anyway, look, you're hinting there at the way you're organised. How is XR organised? Is it do you have like one leader or two leaders, or how does it work?
There's no leaders. It's supposed to be non-hierarchical. The closest you'd get is a coordinator role, which would be for a specific task, and you'd probably rotate it between the group, just because constantly trying to reach consensus is a long-winded process.
Well, very long. I mean, do you ever get there? Sometimes you're going till 1 a.m?
I think one way that makes it quicker, in a way, is that XR has been quite clear about what its vision of change is. And that's made, if you go to any of the meetings, there's induction. And what people broadly believe is made very clear with the demands and 10 principles. And then it's kind of a self-selecting sample people who come back.
Do you want to talk about those demands and the principles?
So there are three aims. The first one is for the government to speak the truth and to declare a climate emergency and to act as if that truth was real. The second one is to make a legally binding commitment to go carbon neutral by 2025. And the third one is to create a citizens assembly to respond to the climate emergency.
This carbon neutral thing, I think you really got to have to sell that to the mass of the public, because we're made of carbon. How can we be carbon neutral?
I think it's overall. So obviously you'll use some things that will release carbon. Just, it's kind of inevitable. But it's on balance. So if there's a certain types of agriculture sequester more carbon than they use. And we don't go to any particular policy, but there's a project called Drawdown that has shown that it's completely feasible.
And what do you say to these people that say, well, actually, climate change isn't man-made, it's changing, it changes all the time anyway?
Well, it's a matter of degree. And I mean, there's people who say the Earth is flat, and there's a point where you just have to...
But hang on, but there is some sort of argument that says that the climate does change on its own. I mean, we had, in the 1600s, we had the Thames freezing over. We had several years of extreme freezing cold temperatures in Britain and no crops, basically. So
That was from a volcano.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying that was a specific thing that caused it?
There was something that caused it.
Okay. So... You're absolutely sure that there's no argument that man is not causing this climate change?
Yes, there's a consensus, as near as you get to a consensus in the scientific community. There have been changes in the past before, but they've also been disastrous. There's been 6 mass extinctions. One of them was an asteroid. All the others were from rises in carbon in the atmosphere.
What do you think would happen if we don't do anything, Luke?
Then you'll start we'll start hitting these feedback loops where it'll run away on its own and it'll be unchangeable because there's like different steady states at which the Earth can be. And at the moment we're in one. And if we move out of that steady state, there's no telling really what will happen. It'll be disastrous. It'd be a very unpleasant world to live in.
Would it be very hot or very cold or what?
There are actually some models. One point where the Earth can stabilise is it's all completely iced over. That's unlikely. You don't know. It's hard to tell the exact probabilities, but probably be hotter. Mm-hmm. It's just once you move out of steady state, it kind of goes wild and there's no predicting what will happen.
I mean, I think if you talk to anyone that lives in sub-Saharan Africa, they'll tell you something is definitely changing with our weather, you know, people finding it very difficult to grow crops, etc. Anyway, so we're getting back to how you're organised. How is it possible to actually make decisions when you've got such a lot of people and you say that actually nobody's in charge?
Because we want the same thing. I think that. And the way of doing XR manages to do that is to have quite a lot of trainings and to be clear and transparent about what it's about.
Now, I noticed there was actually a piece in the Bristol Post about XR doing a training session of non-violent direct action here in Bristol. Was that quite a big event, small event? And, you know, what's involved in that? I suppose the idea is to just prepare people for what to expect.
Yeah, there's a little bit on your rights and what to expect if you get arrested. There's some role-playing and working at de-escalating a situation. So, like, if someone shouts at you, a good idea is to start at the same volume as them and slowly calm down. And so you kind of mirror them in that way.
I understand you're planning something in April in London. So, first of all, why in London? And secondly, what are you planning?
London, because it's the capital and it's where the elites live. And they're more concerned by what affects them. And it'll be, Monday the 15th at 11 a.m. in Parliament Square. And first is to meet there and then to shut down central London by blocking the roads.
But I mean, surely, what about ambulances, things like that? Are they going to be allowed to go through?
The emergency services do have contingency plans for these type of things and they've been warned in advance.
That's another good question, isn't it? Do you chat to the police beforehand? Do you say we're going to do this and that? I mean, there must be a temptation to not give your plans away to them.
No, we're completely open, because so many left-wing movements have been infiltrated by the police and things like that. One way of getting around that is to just be completely upfront.
Well, we've had this Pitchford inquiry, haven't we, recently, with the police sending agents in having children even with activists who haven't even broken the law. And that's ground to a halt because the police have refused to give the names of all of the people involved. Yeah. And a complete miscarriage of justice, really. Yeah. So those that have committed crimes within the police have just been allowed to get away with it. I suppose you might expect that. The police are not going to find themselves guilty of breaking the law. In fact, what some people have described as hacking people's lives. The sort of thing that we were told that the East European Stasi used to do has been happening in Britain to legitimate environmental campaigners like yourself that haven't actually even broken the law. So is there a frosty relationship or a good relationship with the police?
I think that depends on the individuals within XR, but we... It might depend
on the individual police.
Too. And the individual police as well.
Yeah. But being open is an interesting... So you're able to just tell the police exactly what you're planning to do.
Yeah, you say, this is what we're doing. They say, you shouldn't do that, that's illegal. And we say, okay, we're going to do it anyway. Right. And it's hard to get annoyed or aggressive with someone who's just been completely open and quite friendly. And it offers the opportunity for backfiring.
Okay, so if anyone's interested in joining you in London, what should they do?
They should go on the Extinction Rebellion website. There's a briefing of what to expect. It's a bit vague because
that gives you a bit of an idea. But I mean, there are local groups meeting, aren't there? So probably one of the things to do is actually go and meet people and talk to them.
Yes.
Here in Bristol, you've got two groups. You said one at Malcolm X Centre and one in Southville. So what's the best way to find out where they are and go along and meet some XR people?
There's a Bristol specific Extinction Rebellion website. So you can search for that, and that has both of them, all of you on Facebook. You can use.
Can we have that? Can you give us that website now?
xrbristol.org.uk.
Where and when do the groups meet in? Because that might be handy for people if maybe they haven't got the internet.
Yeah.
Or like me, the internet isn't working at home from time to time, or get cut off or whatever.
The one in South Bristol is on Tuesdays at the Quaker Meeting House, 52 Wedmore Vale. And the other one is at the Malcolm X Community Centre on City Road on Wednesdays.
At what time?
They are both at 6 to 7 is a meal, and then from 7 to 9 is the meeting. So if you have time, it's quite nice to go to the meal and have a chat with people. The food's pretty good normally.
Luke Watson from Bristol Extinction Rebellion, more power to your elbow. So Luke Watson was an activist, now back to the brains behind Extinction Rebellion, and Professor Colin Davis from Bristol University.
So as I mentioned before, one of the difficulties that one encounters when thinking about civil disobedience is the fact that one has to think about different perspectives and one's own perspective on the clash between moral and legal obligations may well differ from others. And of course, a good way of exploring different perspectives is through literature. So for my wildcard book, I've chosen a recent novel that's all about different perspectives on protest. It's called Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist. And it's the debut novel by Sunil Yapa. And I think it's really an extraordinary book. It's about an event from not too long ago, the protest against a World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle that took place at the end of 1999, kind of ushered in the new century. And this protest, it began as the largest act of mass civil disobedience in the United States for many years, with around 50,000 peaceful protesters. But it descended into mayhem. And it's now often referred to as the Battle of Seattle. And the novel focuses on a single day, and it tells the story from the perspective of multiple different characters, protesters, police officers, a conference delegate from the Third World. And each of these characters is trying to do what's right by their lights. They each have a moral sense, but it pulls them in different directions. The police officers, of course, are driven by a belief in law and order, but not in a mindless way. They're motivated by a genuine wish to serve and to protect. And the protesters, on the other hand, are driven to break the law by a strong sense of what's right, by a deep empathy for people in the third world, for the poor, people whose homes are being destroyed, who are being forced into virtual slave labor by free trade agreements that are really all about corporations getting access to cheap sources of labor that have the lowest possible working conditions. And the book portrays each of the characters sympathetically. It builds the tension relentlessly. And it captures the tragedy of how a non-violent protest descended into violence. And part of the tragedy of the book is that it feels as though there's a certain inevitability about the way events play out. And a further tragedy is how the complexity of the situation is ultimately reduced to a brief headline, a scrolling banner on the TV saying, "Violent protesters clash with police." So to give you a flavour of the book, I'm going to do a short reading from chapter 2, where we're introduced to John Henry, who's a veteran of nonviolent resistance and one of the organisers of the Seattle protest. And at this point, he's watching the march and he's surveying his people as they go by chanting slogans. They said, "The future belongs to us." And maybe it did, but they looked so young and fragile. And when the time came, would they have courage? Would they have the discipline to make it so? Look with him at his people. This man who once preached from a pulpit, John Henry, who was wound up and weary with too much love, too much joy, too much rage. How many shelter cots that barely registered the man's weight, so light he was. The soft pillow of how many stone steps had cradled his head. John Henry, who had lost his church, look with him at his people. Look at his God made manifest in every form and shape of the broken world. Look with him at how they exit the church in an orderly fashion and tip their chins to the sky. Look at how they come from the darkness of their homes, backs stiff, stretching and tying the bandanas tight, checking one another's faces for an idea of what violence this day might bring. Look with him at these wet American faces, ordinary and beautiful, and tell me you don't feel more than a little bit afraid. They wanted to tear down the borders, to make a leap into a kind of love that would be like living inside a new human skin, wanted to dream themselves into a life they did not yet know. He heard them in the streets saying, "Another world is possible." And beneath his ribs, broken and healed, and twice broken and healed, and thrice broken and healed, he shuddered and thought, "God help us. We are mad with hope. Here we come."
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, hello, Tony. I'm Freeman from the Alles Schall und Rauch blog, which I write since nearly 20 years for the German-speaking public. And I mainly cover international politics and try to show the background, what is really happening. And so also for me, it's very interesting, all these attacks that are happening against churches around the world.
Now, why is it that you think that you've got a perspective that is better than, say, Deutsche Welle or CNN?
Well, of course, they have their political correct narrative that they push. And what I do, I try to see behind the curtain and look at all sides and try to be independent. And I don't have a dogma to push.
And have you got any insight from your life, which is maybe that other people won't have had? What was your background?
Well, It's like this. I've been always against wars, going back to the Vietnam War, because I was actually conscripted to go to the Vietnam War when I lived in Australia. As a young man, I lived in Australia for 7 years, and when I turned 18 and became 19, I was conscripted to go to the Vietnam War, because as many people don't know, this was also what you can call the War of the Willing, which means the ANZAC military alliance, which is the Pacific equivalent of the NATO, ANZAC, New Zealand, Australia, and America, they were also in Vietnam. A lot of people don't know this. Actually, there were a total of 10 countries in Vietnam War involved. So when I was conscripted, I talked to a lot of veterans, Australian Army veterans who came back, and I asked them, look, I have to go to the Vietnam War soon. What can you tell me since you were there and you have come back? And they told me all the horrible things that are happening there. And they told me, you know, kind of do everything, but don't go there. So this is where my anti-war stance dates back to 1971, more or less. And so I look at all the conflicts and all the reasons they tell us for wars very critical. And I look at the lies they're telling us, why we have to go to all these wars.
I know you were living in Switzerland for a long time, but you decided to get out. Why was that?
Well, the problem is that Switzerland has been under pressure from the surrounding countries and also from America since more than 20 years. Because they don't like that Switzerland is kind of a neutral, independent country. So they have been undermining all the Swiss, typical Swiss traditions for since the perestroika, since 91, they have been trying to destroy the Swiss typical things like, they destroyed Swiss Air. They have destroyed the banking system. They've destroyed a lot of other traditional things in Switzerland. And the politicians did not fight back. They caved in to all this pressure from the EU and also from NATO.
I think many people see Switzerland as one of the few countries that really is independent-minded still.
Well, that's only an image. In reality, it's not there because, you know, British troops train in the Alps in Switzerland. They train for Afghanistan in Switzerland. Also, the Americans train in Switzerland. And also, the German Air Force flies into Switzerland. So these things only appear when one of their planes crashes into a mountain. Then suddenly, what the hell are they doing here? And that's how you find out.
Now, I know you blog in German and you've got quite a good following in Germany, but it's lovely that you're such a good English speaker, because I'd like to get your take on what happened in the Christchurch mosques with this horrific attack with this guy from the far right. He just went in just murdering people. Why do you think that took place? What's the context of it?
Well, I think that he is one of these people that they recruit and train to do these things. You know, they use people. For instance, the mother of him told, or it was it the grandmother who is in Australia, said that when he went on to his through his traveling through Europe, he totally changed. He could not she could not recognize him anymore. So something happened to him in a mental sort of way. And maybe he was recruited and set up to do these things.
Well, you say they. Who are they?
Well, it's the same people who are behind the Gladio, NATO Gladio secret army, which operates in Europe and has done bomb attacks like in Italy and blamed it on the communists. You know, they do these attacks and blame it on somebody, but they also recruit people who do these things from maybe an ideological point of view, which they brainwash, you know?
Now, you're talking about these Gladio, effectively what they are is the fascist terror cells. They basically commit terrorist atrocities across Europe, and they have been doing this certainly over the 1970s and 1980s and into the 1990s. We know that for sure because of the Swiss inquiries, the Belgian inquiry, the Italian government inquiries. And these cells are then used to carry out attacks which are then blamed on whoever the government doesn't want at the time, or whoever the United States and NATO wants to blame for whoever the attacks are. Now, so for example, in Italy, that was the Red Brigades. In Germany, it was the Baader-Meinhof. In Belgium, it was this Action Direct. And all these groups were supposed to be left-wing groups. They weren't, actually. These attacks were all carried out by fascists. But the Gladio origins, I was reading recently, were something called the Nazi Werewolf Units. And they were right at the end of the Second World War. Scorzani and various other Nazis decided to set this whole cell network up. So I wonder if you know anything about the origins of these Gladio units.
Well, they were designed to be so-called stay behind cells, you know, stay behind like the resistance in France during the German occupation to carry out because there was this fear that the Soviet Union would overrun Western Europe, and then they would have these stay-behind people who would then disrupt everything, just like the resistance did in France during the German occupation.
Carrying out sabotage, this sort of thing.
Right. But then, of course, it evolved, these trained people and these weapons and everything that they had were then transferred into this new ideology of using terror to blame it on other people.
Well, the problem was, of course, the Soviet Union didn't invade and these fascist terror cells had nothing to do.
Exactly. So they had to find a new job for them. And this is what they did, you know. And if a government did not follow the rules, then suddenly they had terror attacks in their country.
Now, let's just put the context here. For example, in Belgium, the Belgian government refused to have cruise missiles, didn't they? They said, well, this just makes us a target for a Soviet nuclear attack in the 1980s, in the Cold War, and they refused to have them. And all of a sudden, bombs started going off in Belgium, and the government caved in, and they said, okay, we'll have them, because obviously we've got a problem with Soviet-sponsored terrorism. Actually, all the time, it was just fascist. But how do you link this to Christchurch? That sounds like a long distance in time and space.
Well, don't forget that New Zealand belongs to the Five Eyes. And if you know what I mean. And also, don't forget that the New Zealand government was opposed a lot of things that Israel wanted to do in the United Nations, and then Netanyahu came out with the threat that they will pay New Zealand back, and all these threats were happening.
Well, that's right. I mean, what they said was that the New Zealand government sponsored a motion at the United Nations, which was condemning the Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. So Netanyahu said that that was an act of war, and he said there will be retaliation.
Exactly, and don't forget that this alleged attacker in New Zealand also spent some time in Israel in 2016. So the Israeli government confirmed this, that he was there. So maybe he got also his anti-Palestinian ideology trained there, because everybody who goes to Israel is under a huge propaganda that the Palestinians are bad, that they are terrorists and so forth. And what happened in Christchurch is that Palestinian migrants who were there were the main victims of this attack. They were Palestinians. So there could be a connection there.
What would be the motive, though?
Well, this payback thing. And the other motive is, of course, that they want to disarm the New Zealanders. They want to get rid of all the weapons. I mean, this is a typical tactic to disarm the population using this kind of an attack to get rid of all the weapons that the people have.
The New Zealand government say that by making weapons less available, an attack like this is less likely to happen.
Well, that's nonsense, of course, because if I want to do a terror attack, do you think that laws will stop me? I will always get weapons. Just like the attack in Paris, they had all the Kalashnikovs and all the weapons which they imported from the Balkans, and because there were no. Because of the there are no border checks anymore, they could just put them in their car and travel from Croatia or Serbia all the way up to Paris, and because of the no border control. So if you want to do a terror attack, you always get weapons, and the government can always supply you with weapons. That's not the problem.
So why do you think that the mosques were targeted, apart from, as you just said, that there were many Palestinian ex-refugees, migrants there?
Yeah. Well, you see, what is happening is you want to stir up trouble. You want to attack mosques and kill Muslims. And then, on the other hand, you will instigate also an attack on Christian churches and kill Christians. So that this whole thing, each group stirs up, the hate is stirred up, and then they fight each other and so forth. So that's the whole idea behind this. Also, the desecration and burning of churches in Europe, in France, in Germany. I mean, the media is not covering this, but there are more than 100 churches in the last 12 months were attacked in France.
Now, we've heard about the fire at Notre Dame, but we haven't really heard about the burning of Catholic churches in France and other sorts of attacks. So do you think that there's any chance that the attack on Notre Dame was deliberate? It wasn't just an accident. Macron has made it clear he believes right from the day after it happened that it was just an accident.
Well, according to my research, the person who was in charge of the security and alarm system, fire prevention in Notre Dame said that, for instance, an accident caused by a short circuit in the cables, etc., is impossible because all the cables were renewed just a short time ago. And they put in alarm sensors, fire sensors, etc. So it's impossible that this was caused, for instance, by a short circuit or something. And so forth. So it looks very much like this is a deliberate fire. And don't forget, you can cause a fire today without being there. You can just use a laser beam and point it at the tower, which was out of wood, and you can cause a fire with that. Like using, how do you call it, a piece of glass, and you use the sun to focus it onto a point and then onto wood, and then the wood starts burning. You can also do it with a laser beam, for instance, from 100 meters away. You don't have to actually go into the church to start the fire.
I mean, some French people have said that, well, it was Holy Week, and that was also significant. But what evidence have you got of other churches in France being attacked too? Because that certainly would make it more likely that the attack on Notre Dame was deliberate.
Well, I will tell you something. Exactly at the same time, and I mean up to the minute exactly the same time at 6:30, also the mosque in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, a fire started. Did you know this? That a fire started at exactly the same time at the Temple Mount Mosque. The only difference is that there it was squashed and extinguished very quickly, so it didn't cause a big destruction. But the fire started exactly at the same time in Jerusalem as this fire started in Notre Dame.
Oh, now, Easter Sunday, we saw this horrific attack in Sri Lanka. Now, 320 people dead, something like 30 or 40 children. One does wonder what possible use it can be killing children. All that will do is cause people to despise and hate whoever's doing it. I mean, is there really any point for terrorists at killing children?
Of course not. You see, that's a very good point. Let's say if I were a real terrorist, then I would not attack metro systems and trains and airplanes where I always kill civilians, or I drive a truck into a Christmas market like in Berlin where I kill innocent people, or here sitting in a church. That already shows to me that this is not a real terror attack. It is just to cause hate. And because if I'm a real terrorist, I would attack those guys who actually caused the wars. I mean, the people on top, but not innocent people. You understand what I'm trying to say?
Of course. And the other thing is, you don't really need...
Isn't it interesting that nobody who caused the Iraq war, like Bush and Tony Blair, they never get attacked. Nobody attacks them. And all the other people who caused all the wars, or Hillary Clinton who caused the Libyan war, I mean, they're not being attacked. It's always innocent people being attacked.
Well, what about the idea of, you're someone who's been in the military, a suicide bomber. You don't really need to be a suicide bomber to attack a soft target like a church. I mean, there's very few people pointed this out, but it should be obvious that you don't need to be a suicide bomber to attack a soft target.
What you do is you recruit a patsy, and what you do is you tell him, look, you go with this rucksack, you go over there, and whatever, you play a role. And then you remote control and ignite this bomb without the guy actually doing it. He doesn't even know that he's carrying a bomb. He's just told to go from A to B and be there at a certain time. And then from remote control, you ignite the bomb. I mean, this happens. There are many cases where this happens. I think this something similar happened at the London bombing.
Yeah, but I mean, do you have to be a suicide bomber to attack a soft target? I mean, even if you were consciously doing it, surely you could just put down a bag, walk around the corner and detonate it.
Well, that proves my point. The people who have the bomb don't even know they're carrying a bomb. They walk into a place and then it's remote ignited through remote control. And then they say, well, it was a suicide bomber. But actually he was not. He was just a patsy told to go somewhere.
Right? Do you see any connection between Christchurch and Sri Lanka? Because we've heard from Rita Katz and Site Intelligence and the AMAC news agency that this was some kind of ISIS operation, allegedly, and it possibly could have been in retribution for Christchurch.
Yeah, but who is ISIS? ISIS is an organization created by the intelligence services of America and Israel and British intelligence and whoever is behind them, and Saudi intelligence. I mean, ISIS are all mercenaries. They get paid, and they are organized by these intelligence services. So if they say ISIS is behind it, then they are behind it.
Do you think there's any connection, though, between Christchurch and Sri Lanka? In Christchurch, it was mosques which were attacked. In Sri Lanka, it was churches.
Yes, it's to create hate between the Christians and the Muslims. That's the whole point, that they get it at each other's throat. You see, by doing these things, you will then cause other conflicts that happen. You know, you create hate, and then this is like a snowball effect. It will get much bigger and bigger, because you start these attacks, one at the mosque and the other in the Christian church, and then this snowballs into a big thing, because that's what they want. They want the Christians and the Muslims to attack each other.
Why do you think it is that the Western media just repeats this whole thing of, well, ISIS have claimed this attack, where they don't really talk about who is behind ISIS? Why aren't we getting much analysis from the media?
Because they are controlled, and they are told to tell us only the narrative that they want us to believe. Isn't it interesting that ISIS never attacked Israel, although they are just next door? And not only that they didn't attack Israel, the Israeli military and government cooperated with ISIS and let the wounded ISIS terrorists into Israel to be in the hospital and get medical treatments. And this is all open. I mean, the Israeli government is saying that they did this, right? And also the White Helmets escaped via Israel. So they were the propaganda arm of the ISIS, right? Creating these so-called chemical attacks. I mean, that was all a big media stunt.
Well, the whole business with Syria seems to be slowly finishing now. In fact, slowly Syria is returning to normal. And yet we've seen a big increase in tension between Iran and the US and Israel, with the United States first of all saying the Golan Heights belongs to Israel, not to Syria, which goes against the United Nations resolutions on the Golan Heights, and then also declaring the Iranian Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. Well, actually, it's just part of the government of Iran.
Right. I mean, look, the thing is that Trump is in complete in the pocket of the Zionists in Israel, and actually Netanyahu controls Trump, and Trump does everything that Netanyahu says he should do. So if Netanyahu says you have to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Trump does it. And when Netanyahu says you have to recognize the Golanites, then Trump does it.
What power does Netanyahu have over Trump, though? Surely Trump is his own man.
They must have something on him that they can put him under pressure. They must, after all, don't forget who controls New York and the financial system there. I mean, I worked in New York. I know who actually controls New York. And if Trump was a businessman there and he did all these constructions there, he had to arrange himself with the people who control New York. And that's why he is, they must have something on him and can control him. That can be the only thing that, after all, don't forget the job, the main job of all secret services, be it CIA, MI6, MI5, and also Mossad and BND, their main job is to get dirt on the politicians so that they can blackmail them. That's the main job.
So are you suggesting that New York is really just controlled by a kind of mafia oligarchy?
Absolutely, the financial system and the money people, right? And that's why also 9/11 happened and things like that. I mean, we all know, or people who can study a bit further than what the media says, knows what happened in New York at 9/11. I mean, who's behind it?
Tell us.
Well, it was an operation organized by also the secret services, mainly Saudi Arabia, the CIA, and the Mossad. These three organizations were behind 9/11, and they did this. I mean, this is what you call the deep state. Don't forget that all the secret services are a state in the state. And that's why President Kennedy wanted to destroy the CIA, and that was probably one of the main reasons why he got killed. That he saw that he could not, as a president, do things because there was this deep state blocking things, enforcing him to do things that he didn't want.
But what would be the motive? What would be the motive, though, of 9/11 if it was done by the Mossad, the Saudis, and the American intelligence?
To blame it on Arabs. I mean, they blamed it on the bad Arabs, and out of that, they were able to tell that Iraq was behind 9/11 and that they should attack Iraq and all the other things they did in the Near East. You know, that was used as a pretense for all the following wars, and also to put in place the police state and the all the listening and spying and total control over all communications. That's what happened out of that. That's the reason why they did it.
Okay, and
For me, Notre Dame is more or less like the Reichstag fire. It looks very much like the Reichstag fire, put fire to the German parliament, the Reichstag, and blamed it on the communists, and were able to then persecute all the communists and put them in the concentration camps, and also to put in place the whole police state that was used.
What about the Gilets Jaunes in France? I mean, the it does seem to be quite a lot of resistance in France against what the oligarchy are doing, particularly represented by Macron, who's a former Rothschild banker. The French people just are basically saying, just get rid of him. We've got to get rid of him. We don't want him. And this is also partly a campaign against Brussels. So, and you know, the idea of the Brussels imposing on many European countries these technocrat leaders and technocrat financiers. So what do you make of the Gilets Jaunes?
Well, the Gilets Jaunes is, as far as I can see, a true uprising by the French people, because there is no central control. It is totally decentralized. There is no figurehead. So it is not the usual uprising that we've seen in other places where there is a Soros behind it, or whoever else, or the American state foreign ministry or somebody who finances the Yellow Vests in France is really a grassroots uprising. And the latest news is now that the number of police who have committed suicide has doubled since the beginning of year compared to the last year. So there is a big moral problem in the police forces, which on the one hand are being forced by the government to go against the French people, and then they are in a huge conflict, and this brings a lot of policemen to commit suicide because they cannot handle this conflict.
There's
what
also
they see as morally right and what the government is trying to do.
Well, there's also a lot of backlash against Merkel in Germany, against migrants there. I just wonder whether you think the project of the European Union or the United States of Europe is coming to the end of the line, because it looks like many countries, Italy particularly, the UK attempting to Brexit, it means that there may not be a success to this United States of Europe. Where do you think that one is particular project is heading?
Well, it is heading into the direction that those countries who are actually the payers of the system want to get out, and then the EU will be left only with countries who are on the receiving end. Like all the Eastern new EU members. So I mean, if Britain goes out, there is one big contributor who is, will be gone. And who is going to take up the slack then? Is it going to be Germany or whoever? So that's a big problem, that the EU is actually falling apart because they think that with their central government, which you cannot elect in Brussels, you can dictate all the countries what to do and punish them if they don't do what they are told. And this is a rebellion against this central government thing in Italy and in all the countries who are suffering economically from the euro.
But you say it's not elected. We're just about to have a European elections.
Yes, but that's just a pseudo election. That means you have to know that the 751 members of the European Parliament are only figureheads. They have nothing to say. They cannot, for instance, initiate laws. I mean, what kind of a parliament is this if you can't initiate laws? The laws are made by the commission and by the bureaucrats behind the commission, and they bring in the laws, and they only have to inform the parliament about these things. The parliament itself cannot initiate any laws, so it's useless. It's a pseudo-parliament, right? I mean, I've talked to parliamentarians and I asked them, what the hell are you guys doing? You can't do anything. You're just getting your 15,000 euros per month and all the other goodies that you get, but you can't do anything there. I mean, you just sit there and talk about things, but you cannot actually do what a normal parliament does, and that means laws and control the government.
Okay, Manfred, whereabouts do we find your blog online?
Well, if you Google Alles Schall und Rauch, A-L-L-E-S, Schall, S-C-H-A-L-L, and Rauch, R-A-U-C-H, which translated means more or less, it's all smoke and mirrors. If you Google that, then you will find me.
Okay, Manfred Petrich, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that is cognitive psychology professor Colin Davis and activist Luke Watson, both from Extinction Rebellion. And also Manfred Petrich from Alles Schall und Rauch, the German language blog All Smoke and Mirrors. Also thanks to studio engineers Dave Bazenko and Josh Chivers. Dialects are Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious spare time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the national volunteering website do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.